Tuesday, September 9th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, one of three women leading the opposition in Belarus has been taken into custody.
The focus seems to be like this shift in Mr. Lukashenko's tactics, where now he is actually more interested in trying to target certain members of the opposition rather than terrorizing the population.
South Africans express anger over a new book claiming President Trump privately disparaged their beloved Nelson Mandela.
According to the book, Trump said shortly after Mandela's 2013 death that the former South African president was no leader.
Also ahead, despite the roadblocks from the ongoing pandemic, the Rolling Stones are opening up a store in London. It's all on today's International Edition. With less than 8 weeks to go before the election, U.S. President Donald Trump campaigned in Florida and North Carolina Tuesday. His challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden, had no scheduled events. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports.
In statements, the Biden campaign says voters in Florida and North Carolina will not be hearing from the president any White House plans to overcome the coronavirus pandemic or a strategy to put people in those states back to work. Trump continues to hammer his opponent, warning that a Biden presidency would mean caving to China on trade and the destruction of America's suburban communities. Those suburban voters in battleground states are crucial to the president's reelection chances. Most major polls show Trump trailing in several swing states where he defeated Democratic Party candidate Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. Steve Herman, VOA News at the White House.
South Africans are angry about American media reports that President Donald Trump privately disparaged South African icon Nelson Mandela, the nation's first black president and Nobel Peace laureate, before taking office. The comments, which Trump denies having made, are part of a tell-all book by his indicted former lawyer Michael Cohen. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
President Trump's alleged comments about South African icon Nelson Mandela are ruffling feathers in the Rainbow Nation, with the beloved leader's grandson sharply criticizing Trump for his leadership, and with ordinary South Africans clamoring to the defense of the leader many here simply call Tata, or father. Trump's comments, as put forward in a book by his former lawyer Michael Cohen, were reported by American media over the weekend and were strongly denied by the White House. Cohen was convicted in 2018 of a slew of charges, including campaign finance violations, tax crimes, and making false statements. White House spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany issued a statement over the weekend that said Cohen lacked credibility and noted he was a disgraced felon found guilty of lying to Congress. According to the book, Trump said shortly after Mandela's 2013 death that the former South African president was no leader. The other reported comments include an expletive Trump has allegedly used to describe African countries, plus slurs against black people. Mandela's grandson, Ndaba, spoke exclusively to VOA on Google Hangouts shortly after the comments began to spread through South African news.
Donald Trump is the last person to speak about Nelson Mandela, what type of leadership, you know, because he needs to look at the failure of his own leadership, because America is currently burning right now, you know. There have been several Black Lives Matter movements across the country where people have been rioting, people have been burning doors and you name it, in protest of the continuous killing of black people by the police cops.
The Mandela Foundation, in a statement this week, said, "We do not believe that leaders who conduct themselves in the way Mr. Trump does are in a position to offer authoritative commentary on Mandela's life and work." And the ruling African National Congress Party also issued a statement on the alleged comments, saying on Tuesday, "All freedom-loving people of the world are appalled by these insults, which come from a person who, himself, is not a model of competent leadership." Mandela received the 1993 Nobel Peace Prize for his role in ending the racist apartheid system and ushering South Africa into a peaceful new era. In South Africa, he is universally loved and ever-present. Since 2012, his face has appeared on all of the nation's money. Mandela said that to his knowledge, his grandfather did not have a relationship with Trump and did not speak of him.
When you attack Nelson Mandela, for me, it says that you clearly do not see or value the very same principles and values that the people that we see as progressive in this world who are trying to create a much more united world, that you are not really much a person who has those same values. You know, we see him as a person who has actually created disparity and even division, not only in America, but, you know, influenced the cohesion of the global community.
Trump has publicly made comments about South Africa before, tweeting a week after Mandela's death that the nation was a crime-ridden mess ready to explode. VOA approached dozens of people in three locations in Johannesburg. Many did not want to speak about Trump, but those who did were invariably critical of the American president. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has not publicly responded to the alleged comments. U.S. Ambassador to South Africa Lana Marks, a Trump appointee, said in a statement that she had discussed South Africa numerous times with the president, and he has only ever spoken positively about the country. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Belarusian protest leader Maria Kolesnikova has reportedly been detained at the border in Ukraine a day after her allies said she'd been grabbed off the street by masked men. The circumstances of her attempted journey to Ukraine are not completely clear, with some media reports initially suggesting she had made it across the border, something border guards on both sides later denied. Joining us now for the latest on what is known is reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks for being with us. So what do we know right now as to what happened and where she may be?
It's a strange story, so hold on. This involves Maria Kolesnikova. She is one of this kind of dynamic trio of women who've been involved in opposition politics in Belarus. And the story really starts on Monday. She was last seen detained by masked men who dragged her into a van and drove off who knows where. And so, of course, there were concerns that her family filed a missing persons report. Her phone was turned off. The Interior Ministry in Belarus said they had no idea where she went. Interestingly enough, the KGB, the Secret Security Services, made no comment on her whereabouts, which had, of course, people interested in what maybe they knew. Now, fast forward to Tuesday morning, and we have a different story. We hear from essentially government officials that she was arrested on the border of Ukraine trying to leave the country with two other opposition leaders who also, frankly, disappeared the day before. And actually, as this story is kind of unfolded, we've realized certain things. Now, one of those is that while these two members of this team ended up in Ukraine, they subsequently gave a press conference in which it became clear that Kolesnikova, the Belarusian authorities were trying to deport her, trying to get her out of the country, as they've done with other members of the opposition. Mm-hmm. To fight this, she actually ripped up her passport. So there was no way she could actually, that the Ukrainian authorities could accept her, even if Belarus wanted to get rid of her. And so now she's in detention. Her colleagues have since given a press conference in which they've explained the circumstances of this. Meanwhile, the Belarusian authorities say that she's been held for trying to flee the country under what circumstances isn't quite clear.
It sounds like her colleagues have said that what you said, she didn't want to be forcibly expelled. That's why she ripped up her passport. But we're hearing that she was apparently pushed into the back of a car yelling she wasn't going anywhere and that her whereabouts are now unknown.
Well, we do know, actually, her associates have since figured out, in theory, where she is. So we know she's near the border of Ukraine in a transit zone prison for the local border patrol. But what's interesting here is this seems to be part of this pattern by the Belarusian security services that are loyal to Alexander Lukashenko, the president, of trying to kind of decapitate the opposition. In the wake of these elections, we've seen these mass protests weekend after weekend, 100,000, 200,000 people coming out of the streets. And Lukashenko seems to think that by getting rid of some of these leaders, either imprisoning them, which has happened in some cases, or forcing them to flee the country, which has happened in other cases, that he can somehow get control of this. And what's interesting here is that in the case of Kolesnikova, she was one of the last of this trio of women who were involved in the run-up to the election, who kind of galvanized the opposition, who insisted on remaining in Belarus. In this sense, she's a hero. It's important to note that some of her other colleagues, it's not that they're not brave or something like that, they simply were forced because of pressure on their families. For example, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who was the competitor in the race and who many Belarusians feel actually won this election. Mm-hmm. She's now in Lithuania, in neighboring Lithuania, across the border. And her husband is actually in a Belarusian prison right now. So certainly he's in some ways a hostage, and she fled out of fear for her family. And I think that's the important distinction to make here.
Dozens more people arrested over the past weekend with new protests, and some of them facing down a lot of violence. How concerned are Ms. Kolesnikova's supporters that she Should she fear for her life? Will she be released? Is there any sort of history that they can go on as far as how Lukashenko's been dealing with this?
I think that the hard truth is there are no guarantees. There certainly we have examples, for example, Ms. Kolesnikova's boss, in a way. I mean, she was, frankly, she was working as the campaign manager for a would-be presidential candidate who was arrested ahead of the race. This is Viktor Barbiko. He's still in prison. He's a businessman who was hoping to compete against Lukashenko. But there are other cases where, you know, bad things have happened to people. I mean, I don't think anybody quite knows. But the general trend here seems to be, again, if in the wake of this election where we saw all these protests come out, we saw this police crackdown, 7,000 people arrested, many people coming through the prisons of Belarus bearing really, really grim stories of being tortured and beaten. You know, the focus seems to be like this shift in Mr. Lukashenko's tactics, where now he is actually more interested in trying to target certain members of the opposition rather than terrorizing the population. And so what that means for Ms. Kolesnikova, we just don't know.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is condemning the poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, allegedly by Russian agents, and is calling for a thorough, impartial investigation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Rights Chief Bachelet welcomes the news that Alexei Navalny has emerged from an induced coma in a Berlin hospital. The Russian opposition figure was transferred there several days after falling ill on a flight from Siberia following a diplomatic spat between Russia and Germany. Bachelet's spokesman Rupert Colville says the High Commissioner is in no doubt that Russian agents poisoned Navalny with a deadly Soviet-era nerve agent.
The completely unequivocal affirmation by the German authorities and German medical specialists that this was Novichok is pretty extraordinary. Very serious crime committed on Russian soil. It appears to be in no doubt that it was committed. There appears to be no doubt that this, you know, exotic and highly deadly substance, Novichok, was used. And clearly there must be a proper investigation.
Colville notes Russia has been implicated in numerous cases of poisoning or other forms of targeted assassination of Russian citizens, either within Russia itself or on foreign soil over the past two decades. Russian President Vladimir Putin has always denied his country's involvement in any of these crimes. Colville says the High Commissioner calls these acts profoundly disturbing, hard to explain or justify.
The High Commissioner notes that nerve agents and radioactive isotopes such as Novichok and polonium-210 are sophisticated substances that are extremely hard to source. These are not materials that you can buy in a pharmacy or a farm shop or a hardware store.
Bachelet notes Navalny has been an annoyance for the Russian government for a long time. Prior to his reported poisoning, she says he was repeatedly harassed, arrested, and assaulted either by the authorities or by unidentified assailants. She says it is not good enough for the government to simply deny that Navalny was poisoned. She says a very serious crime was committed on Russian soil, and it is up to the authorities to fully investigate and punish whoever was responsible for this crime. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The extradition hearing of Australian publisher and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in Britain continued Tuesday for a second day. VOA's Jason Patinkin got details from journalist Henry Ridgewell in London.
So the US government alleges that Julian Assange hacked into and published classified documents in the years 2010 and 2011 when he was head of WikiLeaks. Some of those very classified documents, videos, cables, images, and messages that the US government says were not only highly classified, but their publication then put the lives of several operatives in the field at risk, including US service personnel. So the US government has asked Britain to extradite Julian Assange back to the United States, where he would face trial on hacking charges, which could carry a penalty of up to 175 years in jail if he is convicted.
Now, what does the British law say about extradition in this case?
Well, this all comes down really to whether the, first of all, the British judge who is overseeing this hearing, and then the British Home Secretary, who has the ultimate decision on this extradition case, whether they believe, first of all, that the crime that the United States government alleges that Julian Assange carried out is also a crime in the UK. So that's the first question that, they've got to answer. So if the judge rules that actually the hacking or the activities that took place would not constitute a crime in the United Kingdom, presumably the judge and the Home Secretary would refuse the extradition. That's the main question. There are other considerations as well that have cropped up in past extradition cases about the human rights of the suspect. Would he face a fair trial? The UK does not extradite people to countries where they might face the death penalty after trial, but the United States has given assurances to the British government that Assange would not face the death penalty.
The defense was disappointed by the first day of the trial on Monday. What happened there?
The major development that we saw on Monday as this hearing got underway was the unveiling of a new indictment, which was revealed had actually been issued in June by the US government, which contained 18 further charges against Julian Assange, many of them, you know, similar accusations, plotting to hack computers, conspiring to obtain and disclose national defense information. The defense for Julian Assange tried to argue that those should be thrown out because they had been a last minute addition. That was dismissed by the judge. And then the defense tried to argue for a delay to the hearing so that they could look at these new charges and come up with a defense. That was also dismissed. And their other argument is that they have not seen the defense counsel, have not seen their client, Julian Assange, in 6 months because of the coronavirus pandemic. So they are arguing for further extensions. That's likely to be a major feature of the hearing as well in the coming weeks. The hearing is scheduled to last 4 weeks, but don't be surprised if there are further delays down the line with further appeals, possibly further delays if there is another outbreak of the coronavirus in London and in the UK, and if that delays court hearings further. So still a long way to go in this whole process.
And moving forward in the trial, who will the courts hear from?
They will hear from academics, journalist academics, who will hear about journalistic practices, about whether these are questions of free speech, whether they were in the public interest, because the defense for Julian Assange claims that many of these publications that were made on WikiLeaks revealed abuses and crimes by, U.S. Service personnel or the U.S. Armed Forces themselves as well. So these are key questions about freedom of the press versus confidentiality and hacking, some of those really deep questions that go to the root of modern society.
London-based journalist Henry Ridgewell speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Uncontrolled wildfires continue to rage across the U.S. West, incinerating the Washington state town of Malden and threatening communities in Oregon and California. The fires, driven by high winds and unprecedented heat over the Labor Day weekend. Two Myanmar soldiers have been taken to The Hague after confessing to murdering minority Rohingya Muslims during a 2017 crackdown. The two men admitted to killing dozens of villagers in northern Rakhine State and burying them in mass graves. That, according to multiple news sources and human rights groups, citing statements on video by the men filmed this year. Britain headed into a fresh round of Brexit trade talks on Tuesday, acknowledging it could break international law, but only in, quote, a limited way, after reports it may undercut its divorce treaty with the European Union. As the pound fell on fears of a no-deal Brexit, the government's legal department head quit because he felt a plan to overwrite parts of the withdrawal agreement treaty signed in January was wrong. Images of picture postcard Paris rarely include this scruffy, heavily immigrant Goutte d'Or neighborhood. Stereotypes of the neighborhood feed into a larger debate about racism and immigration in France, but a walking tour aims to counter them and instead showcase the talent and energy of the neighborhood's African diaspora. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has the story from Paris.
Barbès is actually one of the known name of the neighborhood by locals. You know, people usually say that I'm going to Barbès or to Chateau Rouge. They never say I'm going to La Goutte d'Or.
Jacqueline Gompy is explaining the history of La Goutte d'Or as she takes a visitor on one of her so-called Little Africa walking tours. Like other aspects of this northern Paris neighborhood, perceptions and reality sometimes clash. Many Parisians consider the Goutte d'Or a no-go zone of prostitutes, drug dealers, and petty criminals. It's also seen clashes between youngsters and French police, and recent anti-discrimination protests inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States. Gompy's walking tour offers another side.
From what I was seeing externally and also specifically in the press is that the neighborhood had a very bad reputation locally and also internationally. So I really wanted to change the narrative about that.
Her tour winds through a kaleidoscope of African restaurants, bookstores, and night spots, and past a friendly and trendy new coffee shop run by Nigerian Bosun Ola and his French partner, Philantham.
We're a cafe in kind of like the British style. We serve breakfast, lunch, gattos. We do a jollof rice, which is like an African dish.
One of the last neighborhoods to become part of Paris in the 19th century, Goutte d'Or has always been home to low-income workers and immigrants from Italy, Spain, Poland. Now it's an African melting pot.
You have the North Africans and you have the Sub-Saharan Africans. And at Barbès, you can clearly see that, I don't want to say division, but those two parts. And the more you get deep inside the neighborhood, the more you see Sub-Saharan culture and Black people.
That includes Gompy, who moved to France from her native Cameroon when she was 10. 5 years ago, she founded Little Africa, a company aimed to showcase the African side of Paris.
Oh la la, c'est trop, trop bien.
Her narrative emphasizes Goutte d'Or's African cuisine and markets, which draw both foreigners and the African diaspora here, and the fact the neighborhood is becoming a fashion hub.
She's here. So,
hello, hello, hello.
Boutique Paul Vagabond, with its chunky jewelry and elegant outfits, reflects designer Diana Dia's Senegalese heritage. Dia also uses traditional African weave, employing a cooperative of artisans from Burkina Faso. That's another subtext in this walking tour, how this neighborhood's creators are tapping Africa-based talent.
Oui, alors parmi mes clientes, effectivement, alors Beyoncé, c'est pas tant.
Dia has gained international reputation, partly because American superstar singer Beyoncé has worn her creations. She could move her business to a more upscale neighborhood, but home is Goutte d'Or. If locals like herself don't bring change to the neighborhood, she asks, who will? Other Goutte d'Or residents have moved out. Many still come back to buy the spices and other ingredients for traditional dishes, like Louis Cador and his partner Iriel, checking out shoes and colorful creations at an African designer shop. Cator is of mixed Guadeloupean and Ivorian heritage. His partner Iriel's family comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo. They say the neighborhood is becoming more multicultural, but they worry it will become too gentrified and chase out longtime residents. Gompy doesn't think so. Like the rest of Paris's tourism industry, her business has been hard hit by the coronavirus pandemic. She's lost one of her biggest clients, Black American tourists.
What we are bringing in plus of them is the history of another Black population that they had no idea that had a history here in Paris. They only knew about themselves and their history in Paris with Richard White, Josephine Baker, and Baldwin.
For now, she's giving tours to a more European and local audience. Maybe Parisians might also venture out beyond the standard tourist routes and discover a part of their city that many do not know. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
VOA's International Edition continues. A new documentary that follows Swedish teen climate activist Greta Thunberg's rise from a school protester to Time Magazine's Person of the Year premiered at the Venice Film Festival this month. VOA's David Byrd tells us more about I Am Greta.
Filmmaker Nathan Grossman first met Greta Thunberg when she was 15 and staged a school strike for climate change at Sweden's parliament. He asked to follow her for what he thought would be a 3-week shoot. Grossman believed that Thunberg would be one of many activists he profiled in his film. What happened was a year-long project that included visits with heads of state, with Pope Francis at the Vatican, rallies in front of thousands of supporters, and Thunberg's speech to the UN General Assembly in New York. Grossman told the Reuters news agency that he had no idea Thunberg would have such worldwide reach.
I was also thinking, like, Jesus, like, things are, this is like, everything is going so quickly. What a weird kind of rush of train this is, in the sense that, like, we're standing here with the Pope, and just, like, 8-9 months ago, she started this school strike, which I think says a lot about how her timing and also the way that she kind of expresses herself in this very kind of frank and articulate way, how that translated so well into the world.
Grossman also accompanied Thunberg when she sailed across the Atlantic in a racing sailboat to leave as small a carbon footprint as possible. The voyage took more than 2 weeks, and the filmmaker says he wanted to give audiences a glimpse of what it was like to be Greta.
Just I've tried to kind of follow them and her and her father in this crazy journey as much as I can. And I think the objective has always been to kind of take the camera and bring it down to her perspective, because I think we've seen a lot of her in the news media. She's been doing so many interviews, and I wanted to bring the viewer closer to, but how does it feel then to kind of go from nothing to become this this very famous climate activist?
The film had its premiere at the Venice Film Festival earlier this month in Italy. In a remote news conference, Thunberg said that she thinks that Grossman captured her well.
You did succeed in framing me as myself, and not the person that media frames me to be, but not the angry, naive child who sits in the United Nations General Assembly screaming at world leaders, because that's not the person I am. So I think he definitely made me seem like a shy, nerdy person, which is the person that I am.
One of the arguments that has often been used to slow action on climate change is that it is too expensive. Greta Thunberg said by remote that the COVID-19 crisis has shown that world leaders can work together and spend huge amounts of money if they want to.
Because this is such a crisis and we aren't able to handle two crises at the same time, then all other things have been put on hold. And that is just how you, no one expected anything else than that. But now, yeah, we definitely need to understand and realize the urgency of the climate crisis and treat it as a crisis, because otherwise we won't be able to achieve real change.
I Am Greta will air on Hulu in the United States beginning November 13th. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
The Rolling Stones will open their first dedicated store today in London's Carnaby Street, despite the coronavirus pandemic having a drastically reduced number of shoppers and tourists visiting the city. RS No. 9 Carnaby will sell clothes, merchandise, and music, and feature a video wall with a film of the band, a sound wave installation to represent part of the 1960s track Painted Black, and a supersized version of the band's lips and tongue logo. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.
Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London.